Talk given Sunday, 26th March, 1973.
The great teachings of the Upanishads are a wonderful subject for expounding. But one can go on expounding and expounding for one's whole lifetime. And one can go on thinking about the teachings and studying them for a whole lifetime without realizing what the teachings are about. We have already seen that the two most important words of the Upanishads, Brahman and Atma, represent realized transcendence, which means that you yourself, I myself, the person here on earth, has so transformed his whole nature that he is now the unresisting focus for the free inflow and outflow of transcendent energy. And when one is in this state, one is truly in communion. This is the real meaning of samadhi. And it is this state, this state of perfect communion, which is the real meaning of meditation. We think of meditation as a technique, but any technique is a process which begins in time, proceeds and comes to an end in time. A process as a process belongs to the realm of mortality. It is the finite. It is not of the infinite, of transcendence, of God. But the state of communion, the state of meditation, the real samadhi, is one which has quite transcended time and space. It is of the realm of eternity, of the realm which has gone right beyond mortality. But remember, that eternity includes time, and this immortality includes mortality, and this infinity includes all finitude. These are the things which we must understand as clearly as possible at first with the intellect. If we really understand them, then we will not make the innumerable mistakes we make with regard to meditation. So now, bearing in mind the deep meaning of meditation, that it is the state of communion which is realized transcendence, we will be able to see that the usual techniques which we practice, and they are necessary in the early stages, in the kindergarten stages, they are indispensable. We will see that these techniques of meditation are but the preliminary steps which have to be discarded afterwards. That is to say, we do not so much discard them as grow out of them. What value there is in these preliminary steps has emerged into actual faculty, which has become second nature with us. It is a little bit like this. When we are infants, we don't know the language. Gradually, we learn to speak a few words and make sense out of them by hearing others speak them. A little later still, we learn the alphabet and put the words and learn how to build up our words and put them on a piece of paper. Then we can read them and so forth. But when we are mature in mind, all this process just goes on quite unconsciously. You open a book and you just read. You don't think of letters of the alphabet and words of the dictionary. You are at home with the thought which is presented in the written language, just as you are at home with the thought with the spoken word. So too, these early stages of meditation are intended to help us to arrive at the stage which is true meditation, in which we are in communion. And that stage is a permanent state. Now this permanence of that state of meditation must not be thought of as a particular intense act of concentration to the exclusion of the ordinary process of life. That state of communion remains the all-embracing, all-inclusive, total background of our whole being. We don't meditate just with the mind. We meditate with our whole being. It remains the permanent background. It is the totality of us, in fact. And when the circumstance allows us, during the course of the day or days, it becomes the strongly illuminated foreground as well. This is the difference, you see. Just as in ordinary, everyday, organic life, we are specially conscious of the matter in hand, what we are doing. Whether we are playing a game of cricket or cooking a meal or writing a letter or whatever it is. We are specially conscious of the particular thing which needs our attention. But we are generally conscious all the time of ourselves as living beings in the environment. It's somewhat like that. You see? And we well bear in mind that the particular things are related and must be rightly related and rightly evaluated to the totality of our being, which is the general fact of us all through time and space whilst we are alive. So too with meditation. Understand this clearly, and then it becomes possible to be free of all the limitations of selfness. Once that freedom is realized, then this petty little misconceived I is no longer the center of my world. Because as long as this misconceived I is the center of my world, I am an obstruction to reality, to truth, to the great universal life process, which is the manifestation of transcendent reality. And it is man's glory, it is man's destiny to be able to see this and to dissolve away all the limitations within his consciousness and within his whole psychophysical organism in such a way that the purpose of his emergence on this planet is fulfilled. And the purpose of his emergence on this planet means essentially the purpose which the great universal process has, the great trends of growth and life. When this happens, then what we call nirvana is present. The kingdom of heaven is here. If you like to use the theistic phrase, God's will is freely in operation, unhindered by you or by me. The separate, isolatedly conscious, self-conscious individual. And then individuality has come to its full flower. Because within your own being, as the self, as the psychophysical organism, you are a complete whole. Every aspect of you is rightly related to every other aspect and function. And this individual, limited individual whole, or shall I say personal whole, is also in complete and right relationship with the total environment. It is this which marks the peak point of individuality, indivisibility. Not only an indivisibility within ourselves, but an indivisibility from the totality around us and within us. Now you see, under such circumstances, there is no place for selfness to obtrude upon the universal process. No place for the self to intrude upon the affairs of the divine. And then what happens? Those things which are called the characteristics of the divine, for the purposes of talking only, we say characteristics of the divine. Those things which represent the characteristics of the divine are fully functioning through us. Transcendent love, transcendent wisdom, beauty, truth, harmony, peace, and a bliss that is so extraordinary that it manifests as a remarkable absorptive power within our own being to take in each and every circumstance, pleasant and painful alike, without grasping at the pleasant, without rejecting the unpleasant, and allowing it to become transmuted in the crucible of our own being and life into perfection. Now this is something which is quite extraordinary. You think of it. This is the meaning of the manhood in man being completely taken up and merged without distinction with the Godhead itself. That it is man alone on this planet who can do it. This is the fruition of the religiousness in our nature. This is the real meaning of yoga, the release of this kind of being. Now you see why one needs as its fundamental basis, and I can never tire of repeating this, and I hope and pray that you never tire of hearing it. The fundamental basis is absolute purity. If the apparatus which you use for some very remarkable, complex experiment is an imperfect piece of apparatus, well, your experiment will go wrong. Worse still, the apparatus may explode, and there is destruction, unnecessary pain. There is a necessary pain in life, which is the situation in which opposing tensions play their part, and thus bring about the right sort of activity when those opposing tensions are not irreconcilable opposites. That's necessary pain. And everything that one succeeds in bringing to its fruition involves this necessary pain. Consider the work of a great composer. There is inward toil and stress and opposition going on. And he relates the opposites and makes perfect harmony out of it, perfect beauty out of it. I would like today that we all attempt meditation in the profound sense. I think all of you have had the experience of the usual sitting quiet and counting your breaths and forgetting your toes and whatnot and whatnot. All that is very nice, but it's all kindergarten work. Now, where have we got to with it? Are we capable of communion? We may produce pleasant states. Ah, I feel fine. That's lovely. It's so relaxing. It's so pleasant. I can forget my worries and my woes. For God's sake, don't forget your worries and your woes. Transform them. Not so that they are not worries and woes, but the divine lesson which you yourself, the individual, have to learn out of those worries and woes has been fully learnt, by which, because of which, intelligence, wisdom, and compassion all come to flower. Look, the path of the Holy One is full of unutterable woe. The path of a Buddha, it is said distinctly in the Book of the Golden Precepts, is filled with unutterable woe. But you see, if we don't do it consciously, we are all the time doing it unconsciously. We are concerned with getting rid of what is distasteful to us, what is painful to us. This is the hopelessly irreligious approach. What is distasteful and painful to me is my God-sent opportunity. You see? So now, meditation. As I have said again and again, beware of meditation, because meditation energizes all aspects of our being. The good and the bad alike. The tree of life, when we are in the state of communion, in the state of perfection, is the tree of pure life. But that selfsame tree of life is the tree of the conflict of good and evil as long as we are in the imperfect state. And the basic factor of the imperfect state is that we are self-oriented instead of being free of selfness. You see? This is the great difficulty. So now, let us try meditation on the grand scale today. I'm asking for the impossible, in a sense. What I'm asking for is something like this. All of us play some sort of instrument, very imperfectly. I play a mouth organ, you play a penny whistle or whatever it is, etc., etc. And we are all going to improvise a beautiful symphony. Absurd, you will say. No chance at all. Perhaps one chance in 1,000,000,000. It may come off. And you may not know that it has come off. It may come off. So, first of all, I am going to take this, one of the supreme things said in the Upanishads, taught in the Upanishads, about the nature of the Atma. That is a misleading and a bad phrase to use, the nature of the Atma. Because that means that you're describing the indescribable. So having said all this, you will understand what I mean by the nature of the Atma. This is the famous statement by Yajnavalkya, the greatest of the one of the greatest of the Upanishadic teachers. He is called Yogeshwara, the prince, in fact, the Lord, the God, Ishvara, God amongst yogis. That's what Yajnavalkya was called. And these are his words. The Atma is not this, it is not that. It is unseizable because it is not seized. It is indestructible, for it is not destroyed. It is unattached, for it does not attach itself. It is unbound. It does not tremble. It is not injured. This is the statement which gets repeated about 4 or 5 times in the throughout the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Now, it is not this, it is not that. Unseizable, indestructible, unattached, unbound. It does not tremble, it is not injured. Those are the words which have come down through the millennia as one of the profoundest teachings in the whole sphere of religion. Now, try and meditate upon that. That is to say, don't start writing an essay in imagination upon the words. Don't try to ferret out all kinds of profound or wonderful meanings to the words. Try and let the mind be quiet, unresisting to the reality, and let the living truth for which those words are merely an external garb yield up its reality to your being, so that it suffuses your whole being. You are completely sensitive to it. You are utterly taken up by it. See if that sensitivity can open out. I will spend just about 5 or 6 minutes on that. If in the meditation which is attempted, there is not the realization of transcendence through one's being, first and foremost, it is because one strives to realize it. It is not so much the striving which we should blame, so to say, but we should look into the reason why we strive. We strive because we cannot do it naturally. We cannot naturally, as second nature, so empty our being, so completely open out ourselves to the infinite, that we have to strive to make the infinite, the transcendent, come through us. But you see, the infinite and the transcendent, God Almighty, is already in us, through us, all the time. It is the disturbance within our own psychophysical being which obstructs our awareness from remaining in tune with that transcendent real. The mouth organ which I am playing, which I suggested before we started, is making a terrible noise in the midst of a silent symphony. That is why. Don't you notice all kinds of thoughts, ideas, feelings, moods pass through the mind, through consciousness, with extraordinary rapidity. And as they do so, we make constant judgments upon them. Oh, this ought not to be the case. This should be like that. Or, oh, but I am hopeless. I am unfit. And so on and so on. You see how it is all centered round the eye. It is a little bit like this. Supposing we go out on a lovely day, a heavenly beautiful day, into the blissful quiet of the country. What do? We immediately say, oh, isn't that marvelous? Isn't that wonderful? Isn't this beautiful? Oh, how quiet it is, and so on and so on. We obtrude upon the divinity there present. You see, this is the problem. Now, if you watch very carefully, you will find that the whole organism itself is the disturbing factor. The organism itself is the storm, the turmoil in the midst of the infinite peace. every cell of our body bears the impress of our thoughts, our feelings, our desires, our conflicts, our repressions, ambitions, aspirations, everything. Every cell of the body bears the impress. And when we attempt to disentangle ourselves from this terrible net in which we have got caught, every one of those thoughts, feelings, etc., is a little demon that shouts out. Have you ever thought what might be the real meaning of ghosts? They are not psychical entities floating about in space. That's all nonsense. I'll tell you what ghosts really are. How many times since I was born have I, in my anger, my impatience, wished somebody dead, off with his head? How many murders have I committed? Now, every time I think that and feel that, or every time I indulge in a fantasy like that, and it is inevitable for each and every one of us to go through such fantasies when we are small, every time I do that, there is an energy deep down in the well of my subconscious. That energy is this ghost of the one I have slain in desire and thought and imagination. In my ordinary conscious life, I repress them down. But when I am relaxing, as I say, in the waking state, or particularly in my sleep, when for me, as the living being, it is dark when I sleep, isn't it? When I sleep, it is dark for me. Then in the dark, all these ghosts come out. Isn't it a strange thing that in everything you've read about ghosts, they are always in the dark? When the sun shines, or when the shining of the sun is heralded by the crowing of the cock, all the ghosts vanish. What does the shining of the sun or crowing of the cock mean? That now you are consciously paying attention to something else. So back those ghosts go into the unconscious. But they are all very much alive. And they keep creeping and crawling about, waiting for the next opportunity to come and disturb you. And you will say, well, how shall I exorcise these ghosts? By paying full attention to them. That is the only way you can exorcise the ghost. You pay complete and total attention to all that is associated with these ghosts. The anger, the annoyance, the letting go of the reins of virtue and indulging in imagination, the slaying of mighty armies all at a blow in order that my great ego may be satisfied. What a wonderful chap I am. the good old story of seven at a blow in the tales that we read and all that. It feeds the ego. I am omnipotent. Yes, I am omnipotent this way to do wrong, to do evil. Thou shalt not kill is the absolute law. The law of the spirit is absolute. It's only in our ambivalent state that we have the conflict of the relative good and evil. But the law of the spirit is the law of the absolute good. So you see, when we do pay complete attention, the ghost is exorcised. And in the exorcising of the ghost, we have liberated that power within us which can effortlessly live by the law of the spirit. It is only in so far as we can be effortlessly good, virtuous, that we are truly virtuous. Otherwise, we are play-acting. And we have to keep on play-acting until this power in us is liberated and brought to fruition. Now, similarly with meditation. It's no good shouting out, "Oh, dear God, I want to be one with you. Take me in your arms," etc., etc., etc. I am already in the arms of God. It is I who, by my shouting, make it possible for me to be dropped with a bump. You see? It has to be effortless. It has to be natural. Let it come into being. And how shall I let it come into being? By discovering all that in me which obstructs it. That is the only way. Get rid of the dirt in the room, and the room is clean. You don't sprinkle cleanness out of a bottle or a packet in order to get the room clean. You just get rid of the dirt, and the room is clean. And that's that. It's as simple as that. In the psycho-spiritual sphere, but unlike the efficiency of a modern Hoover or something, the task in the psycho-spiritual sphere is extraordinarily difficult. And what's more, it is a task which never ends. The spiritual Hoover has to work continuously, day and night, non-stop. Now, in attempting true meditation, and it is good to try and attempt it, and if we really care, that is to say, not to attain and achieve, but if we really care for the transcendent reality, just the natural, cannot help being totally in love with it, then we will be able to see the truth about ourselves through our failures. And it is only through our failures that we know the truth about ourselves. Now, this is something which we must bear in mind very carefully where the spiritual life is concerned, where the religious life is concerned. What is in reality success is the natural, unconscious thing. It just is so. It just happens. There is nothing to be conscious about it. You and I don't need to be conscious of the fact that we are human beings. It just is so. We take it naturally in our stride. We have only 2 feet, not 4 feet. We have no tails, and so forth. We can speak, we can think, we do feel. We take it naturally, as a matter of course.
Similarly, when the transcendent real suffuses our being with no resistance from us, then it is just natural. We take it in our stride. We are not even aware of it. And this is a fact. You look at some of the statements in the Buddhist writings. You will find it stated in one of the discourses where the Buddha talks about Sariputta, his great disciple. And Sariputta then enters into this state, and then into that, and then into that, until he reaches the climax, which is the nirvanic condition. And he emerges out of that and comes back to the ordinary state of consciousness in everyday life, where the senses and the body and the mind function in the world of things. But, says the Buddha, he never thinks that it is I, Sariputta, who am entering this and that, until I, Sariputta, am in nirvana. There is the secret. It just happens. The absolute isness is free of the limitation imposed by the isolatedly self-conscious seeing subject looking at an external object. If you keep looking at nirvana, or try to keep looking at nirvana as an external object, nirvana is not yours. Nirvana is not through you. When it is through you, you are it. You don't have it. You are it. This is the difference. And when you are it like that, the reality which is expressed with respect to the Atma by Yajnavalkya is present. It is not this, it is not that. Nothing finite, nothing limited, nothing external, nothing specialized and internal, but the one total reality. Unseizable, indestructible, unattached, is your body attached to your body? Your body is your body. That's all. That's the whole thing. It is not attached. Because then there'd be two things. There'd be a differentiation. But you see, there is no differentiation where the ultimate real is concerned. Now, supposing you completely agree with me intellectually on this matter, that doesn't help. Whether you agree or whether you disagree, if you realize the fact, then both the necessity and the situation in which agreement can arise or disagreement can arise are out. There's no need to agree or disagree when you are it. I am a human being with this kind of human body. I don't have to agree or disagree about it. I am it. And that's all there is to it. The realized fact, which means the truth which has become the reality, which is the reality. This dichotomy in our consciousness is the difficulty. And it cannot be dealt with purely by intellect. A really good, clear mind is essential, of course. A penetrating intellect, that light of intellect, that inner light of intellect has to be there, of course. But with it,
has to be this extraordinary sensitivity. Because if the sensitivity is not there, the life is not there. Life is sensitive. Pure perception, pure intellectual perception, need have no sensitivity at all. So you see, when we try to meditate like this, all this is released. And we come to know ourselves more and more as we really are. Now, in connection with what we attempted to do, let us consider something in the Isha Upanishad. I'll first read to you Mascaro's translation. It is the most poetic, the most beautiful translation of the Upanishads ever produced. He hasn't translated all the Upanishads, and those which he has translated apart from the Isha and the Kena, which are small, short ones, no, the Isha particularly, he has not translated any in full. He has just selected excerpts. Now here is the Isha. Behold the universe in the glory of God, and all that lives and moves on earth, leaving the transient, find joy in the eternal. Set not your heart on another's possession. Now do realize this does not refer merely to ordinary worldly covetousness. You see, here in this religious context, if you attempt to live the religious life seriously, you will find envies, jealousies springing up, because someone has attained a state of peace and calm, or developed psychic powers or something like that. Set not your heart on another's possession. And why not? Not only to be free of spiritual envy and so forth, of spiritual ambition and all those miserable things that obstruct us, but because you realize, because you see clearly that where the spiritual life is concerned, realization and fulfillment is unique to you. Realization or fulfillment through you, the particular individual, is never the same as that for any other individual. So when we say, oh, I'm trying to follow in the steps of the Master, be very careful not to try to become a rubber stamp copy of the Master. You cannot do it. And what's more, you will have wasted your life. Use the inspiration of the Master's life to awake from within yourself. And in that awakening, there will come the springs of inspiration and guidance from within yourself as to the particular way in which the beauty of the divine will shine through you. Because every single manifestation of the transcendent real is unique. It's marvelous. And this is the meaning of beauty in the profound sense of the term. This is the sort of thing that Plato, I'm sure, had in mind when he talked of truth, goodness, beauty. Now, I won't read all the verses, only some. The spirit, without moving, is swifter than the mind. The senses cannot reach him. He is ever beyond them. Standing still, he overtakes those who run. To the ocean of his being, the spirit of life leads the streams of action. Mascara is a real poet, you know, the way he translates. No one else has translated like that. He moves and he moves not. He is far and he is near. He is within all and he is outside all. Who sees all beings in his own self and his own self in all beings loses all fear. When you really see yourself in all beings and all beings in you, you will never know fear in the presence of or in relation to any being. When a sage sees this great unity and his self has become all beings, what delusion and what sorrow can ever be near him? The Spirit filled all with his radiance. He is incorporeal and invulnerable, pure and untouched by evil. He is the supreme seer and thinker, immanent and transcendent. He placed all things in the path of eternity. What a translation! Contrast that with this translation by a very, very great scholar, of course. Appropriately, he distributed objects through the eternal years. Appropriately, he distributed objects through the eternal years. Contrast that with he placed all things in the path of eternity. Magic, isn't it? Now, these are the verses that I want to draw your attention to. Into deep darkness fall those who follow action. Into deeper darkness fall those who follow knowledge. Into he who knows both knowledge and action, with action overcomes death, with knowledge reaches immortality. Into deep darkness fall those who follow the imminent. Into deeper darkness fall those who follow the transcendent. Not the words, follow. He who knows both the transcendent and the immanent, with the immanent overcomes death, and with the transcendent reaches immortality. Now I am going to leave aside Mascaro's translation, because he has taken the poet's liberty and used the words action, immanent, and transcendent. But using those words will not enable us to understand the meaning of those verses. They are really extremely difficult, and they have baffled the finest minds through the centuries, ever since the Isha Upanishad was composed. Radhakrishnan, in his translation, for the second lot of verses, uses the terms manifest and unmanifest, where Mascaro uses immanent and transcendent. Mascaro makes it easy for the intellect to understand, but I'm afraid that all these translations as they stand are misleading. This sounds a terribly conceited thing for me to say, but I'll put before you what I have to put before you, and you consider it and decide for yourself. Now, Hume, who, like a true scholar, translates literally, even if the English is not very poetic, as for instance when he says appropriately he distributed objects through the eternal years, translates that last verse quite literally. In the Sanskrit, the words used are sambhuti and asambhuti. Into deep darkness fall those who follow sambhuti. And sambhuti means becoming, the become. And asambhuti, the not becoming, the not become. You see? Then, into blind darkness, those who follow non-becoming. Into deeper darkness, those who delight in becoming. Now listen, for the last one here, becoming and destruction, he says. Because the Sanskrit has sambhuti, which is becoming, and vinasa, which is destruction. He who this pair conjointly knows, with destruction, vinasa, passing over death, with becoming, sambhuti, wins the immortal. Now we must start off with this last verse. Becoming simply means that which is limited, that which is particular, that which is mortal. So note what he says, that through the mortal he wins immortality, not through the transcendent, as Mascaro puts it. You see? And vinasa is destruction. With destruction he crosses over death. How? Now look, in this connection, join up what Yajnavalkya says in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which is of course a much older Upanishad than the Isha. Yajnavalkya says, after having given one of his wonderful expositions in connection with the Atma to King Janaka, he says, it is whilst we are here that we may realize this. Those who realize it not go only to sorrow. Those who realize it become the immortal. Now remember, we are here in the limited state, the state of becoming, the become. Limited individuals. Only whilst we are here as limited individuals can the unlimited, the infinite, the transcendent be realized. That is what Yajnavalkya teaches. Now here in this Isha Upanishad, he says, by means of destruction he crosses over death. By means of the become he realizes immortality. He wins or realizes immortality. The key is here. What is the meaning of by destruction he crosses over death? Destruction of what? That is not told in the Upanishads. How do we experience life? Through our senses and our everyday affairs. Something begins, it proceeds, it dies. And in relation to every single thought, feeling, event, situation, ambition, activity, etc., we associate ourselves with it, and we try to grasp and preserve that which we like, and to get rid of or destroy that which we dislike. Now, in trying to grasp and preserve what we like, we are being foolish, because everything dies. Everything of necessity dies. So, by virtue of grasping, by virtue of self-association with the event or situation, I am born, I proceed, and I die with the event or whatever, or the situation or whatever it is. So that I am caught up in this round of births and deaths in my own consciousness constantly. So I know only death. I know only mortality. The immortal I never know. Now supposing I completely cease to grasp and just watch the becoming process as it goes past. When I do that without grasping, there is no such thing as a separate self-association with the passing stream. No association with it. In what manner, then, am I conscious of the becoming process? I am no longer conscious of the becoming process in terms of mortality, where I, by self-association, am born and die with the event or with the desirable, etc., etc. But I am continuously, permanently aware of the movement of life through the universal process. And this is the only immortality that man can realize. There is no other immortality for man. But the realization of this means that the bliss of the eternal is with you and yours. And not only is heaven's benediction upon you, but you are a benediction to your total environment.